I believe the greatest challenge for true, loving, spirit-filled sons and daughters of the Most High is when we look across the Atlantic here in America and we ponder the future of Jerusalem and Israel, we're torn. We know that Jesus is going to rest his throne from heaven on that precious soil. We know that that land is sacred and holy. We know that Abraham trod that land. David fought great battles on that land. Joshua and Caleb dispossessed the Canaanites, and the 12 tribes were able to settle in that land. The temple of the Most High was built in Jerusalem. Very, very beautiful, expensive, ornate, heavenly structure on Mount Moriah where Abraham offered up his son Isaac. And so for the last few hundred years, there's been this battle, who owns the land? We know who properly owns the land, God himself. But the nation of Israel won the wars. And it doesn't matter, 1948, how they got to get the land. And it wasn't Jerusalem, remember. It was parts of Israel. It's still parts of Israel. It's not all of Israel. So when folks start whining, moaning, and complaining about Greater Israel, what Greater Israel to me is the whole land that was given to Abraham, which leaks into Jordan, right? Obviously, the West Bank belongs to Israel. Gaza, yeah, that was a tough spot. The Philistines constantly attacked from that region, but it was ultimately given to Israel. How it all plays out now is the big question. So going back to my original idea, how do we pray? How do we think? How do we talk about Israel today? It's all like, You gotta cut through so much garbage to have a real conversation about Israel. It's almost like you give up. What's the point? So how does God want us, his sons and daughters, to think and to talk about Israel and Jerusalem? This is what I've been saying to people. Jerusalem has a destiny. The living God, Jesus Christ, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, is going to put his throne there on this earth, and it will be a perpetual throne, as what was promised to David, that his seed, his son, would eventually have the throne forever and ever. Jesus will fulfill that prophecy. Psalm 110, when all his enemies are at his feet, he will come down and he will destroy every wicked, evil, godless thing. Whatever that is, obviously we know their third temple there. It's going to be desecrated, abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel, and then Jesus requoted. That is the final chapter. The final moments is the destruction of the temple and the whole thing that was set up. And I'm sure it's beautiful because it wouldn't be ugly. Why would you look at an ugly thing? And we're commanded to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. We're commanded to pray for prosperity. So if we just settle in on this truth that, I'm talking to myself here, if I pray for her peace, it doesn't matter what my mind tells me about the possibility of peace with all the political talk and the looming realities of the Jews being able to get back the Temple Mount and build the third temple. We shouldn't fight that. This is what's oxymoronic for most Christians because they don't understand how things have to play. The Jews have to be set up for a great final moment with their creator, with their Lord, with their master. They're the beginning. They're the Abrahamic seed. They were before us. They have and possess the oracles of God. They are original caretakers of the gospel. They got the gospel. They got the good news. God chose them, elected them, shepherded them, drew near to them, gave them a template of worship, gave them the creative stories through Moses, the whole beginning. They know the beginning, yet they don't believe it, but they got it in oracles, writings. They got the prophets that we ponder and read and pray over and try to discern what Jeremiah was trying to tell us and what Isaiah was trying to tell us and what Hosea was trying to, and Amos and all these things. They got all that. They possess it. It's in their language. And if you are a believer today, coming from a Gentile background, you must and will and have to love the Hebrew people. Those are your brothers. Yes, they're going to die, some of them, in unbelief, and they're going to go to hell. They're going to be judged, as many have already been judged down through the ages. And how many Catholics and Christians and Lutherans and Methodists have been judged because they were fake, false believers, didn't really understand the claims of the gospel, didn't surrender all, didn't take up their cross, just like the rich young ruler, didn't take up their cross to follow Jesus, didn't submit to his will. So we have a lot of people that made claims. Jews make claims, Christians make claims, Muslims make claims, Buddhists make claims. All these people make claims. But in the end, God knows. In the end, Jesus' eyes see. The eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous. 1 Peter chapter 3. His ears are open to their cry. He knows who are his. He knows who is real, who has a true heart that it pants for God, that loves God, not as dutifully constrained by servile fear to keep some measure of commandments that you'll never be able to keep, because if you break one commandment, you break them all. Because if you don't love yourself and your neighbor, you break them all. You can't please God without a heart that pants after God. You can stumble around like David and have an affair and kill her Bathsheba's husband, who is a faithful, loyal warrior for you, commit a heinous crime against this man Uriah, and yet be the king of Israel that God loved through it all. Why do you think God allowed David to fall like that? I mean, he chose to fall. Like, he fell for the beautiful woman that was somebody else's property. He fell for it in his older years, just like Solomon fell for all these women from afar, made them his wife, and he fell for their idolatrous ways. It tells us that God is exceedingly kind and exceedingly merciful. But what does he require? A heart that beats for him. Passion, romance, love, friendship, loyalty, fidelity. That's what he wants from every human being, young and old.